All right, let's open our Bibles up to the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 30. 1 Samuel, chapter 30. I believe this is the third message that we've had out of chapter 30. And we only have one chapter left to cover. So we are making progress toward the end of the book. We began this study in the month of July of last year, and we are approaching its end. Tonight we will finish chapter 30. We'll look at the remaining verses that we won't get to this morning. And unless I start changing my mind, next Sunday we should cover chapter 31. Then the question begins, what book are we going to next? I have some ideas in mind, but no definite plans. So you'll just have to wonder along with me. Let's look this morning for our text at verses 21 through 25. I want to talk about separating the spoils. Separating the spoils. Now, by way of recap of where we are in the story, David had been living outside of the land of Judah for 16 months. And he had lived outside of the land of Judah, even though the Lord had told him to dwell in the land of Judah. He went to the Philistines and dwelt with Achish, one of the five lords of the Philistines. And Achish gave him a city for his men to live in. And David and his men dwelt in Ziklag, and that became David's headquarters. And David had 600 men with him, and their wives and their children. So that's a pretty sizable town. I live just outside the city limits of Kibler, and Kibler has a grand total of 600 residents. David's men were 600 men plus, I'm going to guess, 600 wives. And I'm going to guess if they were all Americans and had 2.3 children, we're looking at roughly 2,400 people in David's group. Just by law of averages, okay? So this is a sizable town, and David dwelt there. And Achish was beginning to believe that David hated Israel and loved him. And so all the Philistines decided they were going to go wage war against Israel, because Israel was weakened without David there, and they were going to line up and go to war with Saul. And Achish, the leader of the Philistines, came to David and said, "You're going to battle with me to fight against Israel." So David was now put in the predicament of having to fight against his own people. And David and his 600 men went to do battle against their own families, their own nation, their own neighbors. But while they were there, God intervened and made it where the rest of the lords of the Philistines didn't want David to fight. And so Achish said, "Well, nobody else trusts you but me. Go on home and maybe, you know, they'll come around later." Well, when David arrived back home in Ziklag, he found Ziklag burnt to the ground by fire. His wives weren't there. The children weren't there. None of their livestock was there. None of their possessions was there. Everything that David and these 600 men owned was stolen. Every family member that these 600 men had was kidnapped. And the possessions that they had were burnt to the ground. So David, after weeping, and they all wept till they couldn't weep anymore, David encouraged himself in the Lord. And he began to pray, and he consulted with the priest Abiathar. And the Lord said, "Go and pursue them, and if you go and pursue them, you'll recover everything, all of it." So David pursued them. But when they came to the brook Bezor, some of the men weren't able to go across. We're talking about a mountain stream here. Maybe there was a rain, a lot of water. Some of the men were not as able as the younger men. Some of the men were stronger than others. And so 200 of them were left there with all the oxen and with all the carts and the tents and all the stuff that wasn't necessary to fight. All the supplies were left there with 200 men. And David and his 400 went across the brook, found these Amalekites that had raided them, and then attacked them. And 400 Amalekites escaped. David only had 400 men. 400 got away. David killed from dark that evening, all night, all the next day, until dark the second day. David was killing Amalekites and reclaiming their wives, their children, and all their stuff. And when all the killing was over, they began to count their cattle and count their sheep and count their goats and count their donkeys and count their horses. And you know what they discovered? They did not lose one head of livestock. All the husbands and the fathers began to round up their wife and their children and start taking stock of who all was there. And every man's wife was there and every man's child was there. And the promise of God came true. They recovered everything. Isn't that wonderful? It's almost unbelievable. But we know it's believable and we know it's true because we said last week it put forth the picture that Christ will recover all that the Father hath given Him. Jesus said so, all the Father giveth unto me shall come unto me and I will not lose one. That's pictured in God's promise to David that he got back all that he lost. Now, they're coming back. They've rounded everything up on top of their own stuff. On top of this, they've recovered all the stolen cattle, all the stolen sheep, all the stolen horses from everywhere these Amalekites raided. And remember, they raided the Cherethites. They raided the south of Judah, and they raided the land that belonged to Caleb. So there was a large number of livestock there, far greater than what David and his men had, that was also stolen. And they got all of that. So now they're going back home, even though home's burnt. They've got to get back to these 200 men, and that's where we pick up, reading in verse 21. And David came to the 200 men, which were so faint that they could not follow David, whom they had made also to abide at the brook Bezor. And they went forth to meet David and to meet the people that were with him. And when David came near to the people, he saluted them. Then answered all the wicked men and men of Belial of those that went with David and said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart. Then said David, ye shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord hath given us, who hath preserved us, and delivered the company that came against us into our hand. For who will hearken unto you in this matter? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff, they shall part alike. And it was so from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. Now, I've broken this little passage of Scripture up into four pieces. Now, I want to look at each one of them individually. And here's why. I think we can learn a lot from the separating of the spoil. There has to be a fair and honest way to divide what belongs to everyone. My mother devised a plan that worked well between my brother and I. We oftentimes, for breakfast, Mom would fix pancakes. And she always tried to fix 6 pancakes, or 8 pancakes, or 4 pancakes. But sometimes she made 5 pancakes, 7 pancakes, or 9 pancakes. You seeing a problem here? 4 is divisible by 2, 6 is divisible by 2, and 8 is divisible by 2. My brother and I could each split it 50-50. But on the days the pancake numbers came out odd, how do you split that 7th pancake, that 9th pancake? So my brother and I would race through these pancakes so that we could fork the last one and get that extra pancake in. My brother would complain. He didn't cut it down the middle. He's not giving me my half. So my mother developed a plan. You know what she said? One of you cuts and the other one chooses. Can I tell you something? My brother and I got so good at cutting pancakes, it was hard to tell who got the better piece. Because the first time my mother said that, I thought, well, I'll show her. And I just cut a third of that pancake off and thought, ha-ha, I looked at my mother. And my brother forked that 2/3 and began eating. So next time he said, cut it and I'll pick. I said, I cut last time, you pick. So he thought, well, I'll try to cut down the middle. And I would look and I'd get the bigger piece. So we got to where we were so fair with one another because we didn't want the other one to get the bigger piece. We would cut these things down the middle and it was a coin toss as to which side was bigger than the other. You see, if one child cuts and the other one gets to pick, they'll be honest with one another. Well, in our instance, it's not a matter of one side cutting and the other side picking, but there needs to be a fair and honest way of separating amongst these people what's rightfully theirs. David runs into a problem. Let's look first of all at verse 21 at the salute of David. The salute of David. I want us to take just a moment and see how David responds to these 200 men who were unable to follow him the rest of the way into battle. It says in verse 21, "And David came to the 200 men, which were so faint that they could not follow David, whom they had made also to abide at the brook Besor. And they went forth to meet David and to meet the people that were with him. And when David came near to the people, he saluted them." The salute of David. Now, we see here that David got the 400 men and everybody's children and everybody's wife and everybody's cattle. And then they have this massive extra herd that's mentioned in verse 20, the herd that belonged to David, for David to divide how he saw fit. And so they're driving these cattle back. And I don't know if you've ever moved livestock, but it's a slow and laborious process. You know, it doesn't work like it does in the movies. You know, cattle don't go where you want them to go. Sheep don't go where you want them to go. And so there's this process of moving the cattle. And so the people by the brook Besor are waiting on word as to whether their family's been found. And so they come and they begin to arrive, and the people look out there and they see David coming. Let's deal with this little word here. In the middle of verse 21, it says, "whom they made also to abide at the brook Besor." Now, when we looked at this earlier in the chapter, there were 200 men in verse 10 that were so faint they could not go over the brook Besor. There were 200 men that weren't able to keep going, so they stayed there. But notice that it says here in verse 21, they made them to stay there. And so there's kind of a debate going. Well, did David say you have to stay behind, as it appears in verse 21? Or did they say we can't go on, as it appears in verse 10? I'll give you my interpretation. You can disagree with me and be wrong if you want, but I think mine makes more sense. These people wanted to go get their wives back. These people wanted to go get their stuff back. They wanted to go get their kids back. I can't imagine any man being to the point that he goes, "Well, I'm just tired of looking for them. I'll start over." I can't imagine any man doing that. If someone has kidnapped your wife and your children, burnt your home down, and stolen your livelihood, I can't imagine you traveling one day with a posse and going, "Well, good luck to the rest of you. I'm done." But I can very clearly see men who want their wives back, want their children back, want their stuff back, but they can't keep up with the younger men. And you know what that leads to? The younger, stronger men going, "so-and-so slowing us down. We all jumped across the brook Besor. They had to walk down to the shallow water and wade across. Now they're down there trying to get the ox carts and the tents and all the food across. We don't have time for them to be dragging us down." Have you ever went on a journey and you were in a hurry and the person behind you couldn't keep up? Isn't that frustrating? Huh? You ever been in your car and told someone, "follow me," and they insist on driving 10 under and you want to drive 10 over? People often identify with those that go slow, but no one identified as those that go 10 over. These guys were made to stay there partially because they couldn't keep up with those that needed to catch up. You're chasing a group of criminals. So they were made to stay behind. They're slowing down. They want to go. They just can't. Yeah, you know what that feeling is. You want to do something, but your body won't let you anymore. As you get older, you'll become more and more acquainted with what you want to do and what your body will allow you to do. Amen? You may not amen anything else I say, but if you're over 40, you can say amen right there. You can agree with that. And you'll talk about the good old days. "Oh, I remember when I used to work all day." Yeah, you don't do that anymore. You know why? You're not able. Now, you wish you could, but you can't. That's what these 200 men were doing. They were there. They were made to be there. So when David comes back to these men who can't keep up with the younger, stronger men, the Bible says that he saluted them. I learned to salute in the military. You want me to give you a proper salute? The elbow does not move until your hand comes above your shoulder. And these two fingers right here, these two fingers touch the corner of your brow. That's a salute. And your thumb runs flat along the side of your hand. And your brow comes to here. If you do not have a hat on, it comes to right here. And the back of your hand faces those whom you salute. And that's what everybody in the military. You only salute officers, and you only salute out of doors, or you salute when a high-ranking officer enters the building. And that was the only way we saluted. And then one day in training, these generals from England came over, from the Royal Air Force, to watch us train. And this guy walked up, and I mean, the uniform was like nothing I'd ever seen before. It was, you know, European. And he had all these weird medals and stuff on, and I knew the guy was a general because he had big stars on his shoulders. And I stood up and saluted the guy just like this to give him the respect of an officer. You know how he saluted me back? He didn't salute me back the same way. He saluted me like this. I thought, what is that? I mean, this is how you salute. I mean, there's a pop to it. You know, you know what you're doing. You're saluting. And he gives me this like cheerio, and I'm going, what is that? And the instructor happened to be standing there by me, and he saw the look on my face. And he walked over and he goes, them English boys don't salute right, do they? And I said, no, why is that? He said, America salutes with their hand out because they've never lost. English salute with their hand turned back because they've suffered defeat. So David walked up and gave them the backhand because David's never lost. No, I told you all of that just so you understand what the word salute really means. David saluted them didn't mean that he gave them the backhand, the military signal of hello and respect and honor. When David saluted them, the Hebrew word implies he offered his peace to them. Remember how Jesus would enter a room and say, peace be unto you? Now listen, when the Lord of glory speaks peace be unto you directly to you, I bet that gives you a little bit of peace. Huh? When the commander of David's army, David himself, comes back to you who were unable to keep going even though you wanted to, the younger, stronger soldiers said, we've got to leave them at Bezor. No, they're slowing us down. We're never going to catch them traveling at this pace. Well, David could have come back and said, guys, I got good news and bad news. The good news is we found your wife and kids. The bad news is y'all need to get out of here because you're slowing the rest of the army down. We can't keep doing this. Instead, David comes back and says, peace be unto you. How are you? Well, how have you been while we were away? He's intimately concerned about their well-being. He wants to know more about them. Why? He valued these 200 men that stayed behind. Oh, they couldn't keep up with the younger men, but these older men could do things the younger men could not do. He valued them. He respected them. He recognized what too many people in our day don't recognize, that the old and the weak still have a place of service in the larger body. My daddy worked for Pepsi-Cola for 28 years. And he always said the same thing about Pepsi-Cola. He said, it's a young man's job. It's a young man's job. It's a young man's job. You know why? At Pepsi-Cola, you picked up cases and cases and cases of drinks, stacked them, two-wheeled them, unstacked them, put them up, picked up the boxes. And when Dad started there, they were wooden boxes. And you had those dreaded returns because all the bottles weren't like plastic. They were glass. Some of you older folks are smiling. You remember big old glass 1-liter Pepsi bottles? And so all this picking and stacking and picking and stacking and throwing them on the truck and driving the truck and unloading, it wore you out. And so most of the people that went to work at Pepsi didn't last long because their bodies didn't last long. And Pepsi would try to find a place for them to stay if it was at all possible. And a handful of people that started out driving trucks migrated up to some form of middle management and migrated up to some place where they no longer had to pick up cases of drinks anymore. It's a young man's game. But you know what these men that made it from the bottom up to the top had? They had experience. They had knowledge. They had know-how. They were veterans and had seen it and done it before. And they could offer advice about how the young ones are supposed to do it. David knew this. And when David saw these men, he didn't snap to attention and salute them. He said, "How are you? Tell me that everything's been peaceable here. I bring you good news." That's how you ought to approach the older, weaker people. Now, is that how everyone approached these people? Obviously not. You look with me at verse 22. We're going to see some other people didn't share David's sentiment. Let's look at the soldiers' disdain. The soldiers' disdain. Verse 22. "Then answered all the wicked men and men of Belial of those that went with David and said, because they went not with us, we will not give them aught of the spoil that we have recovered, save to every man his wife and his children, that they may lead them away and depart." The soldiers' disdain is not a universal disdain, but it's confined to a little group. A group that the Bible calls wicked men and men of Belial. Now, you want me to give you the condensed Harold Smith dictionary definition of what men of Belial means? Rotten people. There's a number of different words there. They're cheaters, they're crooks, they're evil, they're disliked. But basically, they're rotten men. They're men who have bad intentions. They're men who are greedy. They're men who are covetous. They're men who are jealous. That's what we're talking about here. This group of people said, let's not give them their stuff except their wife. He said, let's not give them their stuff because why? They didn't go to battle with us. Have you ever noticed when you're working with other people, if you're not doing their job just like they're doing it, you're not doing it right or as good? You ever noticed that? Everyone has this idea that if you can't do what they're doing the way they do it, well, you're just no good here. Go find something else to do. I remember one time playing football. They wanted me to play running back. I used to be skinny. You don't believe that, but I got pictures to prove it. I used to be skinny, and I used to be fast. And they wanted me to try running back. And so I tried running back, and I wasn't very good. And I couldn't run all the plays because I couldn't remember all the plays, to be honest with you. I would go over tackle and I should have went over guard. And I'd go over guard when I should have went around the end. And I couldn't remember all the cross, trip, sweep, right, waglet, jet, 7-6. I got confused. And they'd be holding the ball out here and I'd be on this side. And so they said, hey, look, you're no running back. But that didn't mean that I couldn't be of help somewhere. So you know what? They gave me three plays. Well, six. They gave me three to the right and three to the left. I didn't play a lot at running back. But when I came in, it was a certain package that they had for me. You know what they realized? We can utilize Harold occasionally as a running back. I didn't play running back most of the time, but they recognized I had some value there. David looked at these men and recognized that they had some value, but the men of Belial looked at them and said they have no value. No value. And the men of Belial said, if they cannot fight, they cannot stay. Now, folks, if you take that approach to working with other people, if they can't do what you want as you see it fit, then they're of no service to you. You're going to be, of all people, most miserable. So, they said, let's give every man his wife and his kids and depart. Now, why is this evil? Why is this wrong? Is there anything wrong with firing somebody? Sometimes you have to fire somebody. Sometimes you have to tell people it's time to retire. Sometimes you have to tell people that what they're currently doing, that they can't do it anymore. Why is it wrong to do it the way these men did it? They wanted to give them their wives and their children and let them go away. Question number one, where are they going to go? Ziklag's burnt to the ground. Where are they going to go? Israel? Yeah, I bet Saul would love to have them come back. Yeah, come on back, all you that followed David, my enemy. Yeah, come on back, all you that fought on David's side. Yeah, I'd like to talk to you. Just stop by the palace on your way into Israel. Oh, wait a minute. Saul's getting killed. The Philistines are overrunning the land. Where are they going to go back? Back to Israel? No. Back to Ziklag? No. Out into the desert? No. They don't have any stuff. All they got's their wife and their kids. These men of Belial are basically saying, you're not worthy of our work. We have no use for you. We don't care what happens to you. Just get out of here. Now, too many in our day have the same problem that they cannot value the work of others. It's going on. It's going on. Companies are cutting their labor force in half as they grow older because they no longer value their experience. And you know what we're running into? We're looking at companies that have a ton of young people that don't know anything. They can't do what the generation before them did. They just simply don't have any knowledge. That wouldn't have happened in David's army. That brings us to our third thought. We see the salute of David, the soldiers' disdain, verse 23 and 24, the settling of a dispute. I want to pull out five things here that David did in settling this dispute. I think you and I can learn a lot from this. Look with me at verse 23. Then said David, "Ye shall not do so, my brethren, with that which the Lord hath given us, who hath preserved us, and delivered the company that came against us into our hand." Verse 24. "And who will hearken unto you in this matter? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike." Now, how do you settle dispute? Well, only certain people can settle disputes. My mother settled the dispute of the pancakes by having one cut and one pick. David is a position of leadership. No one asked David what they could do. They told David what they were going to do. You know what problems you create when you tell the boss what you're going to do? You automatically make the boss want to tell you how you're wrong. They said, "Let's not give them their stuff back. Let's give them their wife and kids and let's tell them to get out of here." I want you to notice the first thing that David did. He corrected them. "Ye shall not do so." He didn't say, "Let's talk about it. Let's think about it. Let's form a committee to discuss it. Let's put an algorithm in place and see if it'll work. Let's chart it on paper and graph its success." He knew right away this was wrong. Listen to me. If you know something's wrong, correct it. "Well, I know it ain't right, Brother Harold, but I just don't know what to do." Stop! I mean, seriously, stop! "Well, I know it's not right, and I know it looks bad, and I know I shouldn't..." Stop! You see how easy that is? Huh? Now listen, you can't tell the boss to stop. But if you happen to be the boss and your employees are out there tearing stuff up, how about we start with correction? You're not going to do that. Now, if you're a good boss, you're not just going to correct them, but you're going to do it with compassion. Second thing, compassion. "Ye shall not do so, my brethren." That's a term of endearment. These are wicked men, men of Belial. It gives the impression here that they're probably not saved. They're probably not serving God. But he says, "You shall not do so, my brethren." So he's referring to them as in his own company, his own nation, his own religion. He says, "You shouldn't do this." Then he calls them brethren. That compassion will get you farther than loud orders that you bark out. You may have to bark out some loud orders, but you need to do it with compassion. Then he talks about the credit. These guys had a problem, and the reason that they didn't want to share the spoil with those that didn't go is because that they thought they got all the stuff back. David talks, thirdly, about the credit. He got the correction, the compassion, the credit. Look at the latter part of verse 23 with me. I want to make emphasis of three words in the latter part of verse 23. "With that which the Lord hath given us." Given. "Who hath preserved." Preserved us. "And delivered." Delivered to the company that came against us into our hands. Do you see what David did when he corrected them compassionately? He then told them why they were wrong. He said, "You think that you went out and got all this stuff back. God gave it, God preserved it, and God delivered it back into our possession. Don't you think it's God's stuff?" I'm going to tell you what. Your life will get a whole lot simpler if you realize everything you own is on loan from God. And He can come back and get a hold of it anytime He wants. When you get that outlook on life, that it's not mine, I didn't go out and earn it, I'm not a self-made man, I'm a God-given man, and everything I have God gave me, when it goes out the door, it don't hurt near as bad. Oh, you may miss it. Oh, it'll teach you a lesson. Oh, I agree. But it's still God's. When we look at how David settles the dispute, He gave them instant correction, but he did it compassionately, and he revealed to them the problem with what they were doing was who they gave the credit to. That brings us to our fourth thought from settling a dispute, confidence. Look at the first part of verse 24. David now asks them a question. Sometimes when you're given orders, ask a question. David gives them something to think about. He says in verse 24, "For who will hearken unto you in this matter?" Hey, let's think about this for a moment. Have you ever had someone come to you with a problem and go, "Everybody's talking about this. Everybody's complaining about what you're doing. Everybody's upset with the way you handled that." Here's a simple question for those kind of comments. Who's everybody? You keep saying everybody. Who? Name this everybody group you speak of. Oh, it's everybody. Well, who? Oh, it's Jim and Tom and Bill and Bob. Okay. You got five. Well, it's everybody. No, it's not everybody. It's five. It's five. You see, when people come and complain and want to change the program and change the rules, here's what they're going to say. We want it this way. Well, just who is we? And here's what you'll find. It's usually them and their best friend. And they've been sitting around the campfire at night talking about it. And so what David does is he says, "Who's on your side?" And man, they looked around. And I mean, whew, gone. There wasn't nobody on their side. He said, "Who will stand with you in this matter?" He doesn't just ask whose idea was this, but he said, "Who's going to go along with you when I'm David, the leader, and I've made a decree?" Pretty good way to settle a dispute. Confidence that he was right. Let's look at the last one, a conclusion. When you're settling a dispute, it has to end in a conclusion. If it doesn't end in a conclusion, it's just a ceasefire, and shots will be fired tomorrow when the sun comes up. It's got to end in a conclusion. So look at it. Middle part of verse 24. "But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the stuff. They shall part alike." You know what David said? The 200 that stayed here is going to get the same number of sheep and goats and cows out of that herd as the 400 that followed me into battle. That's how you settle a dispute. You make a decision. You make that decision logically. You make that decision compassionately. You make that decision decisively. And when you make that decision, you issue your judgment, and that's the way it is. One of the worst things you can do as a leader is make a decision and change it tomorrow and change it back next week and go back and forth, and nobody ever really knows what's going on. David didn't do that. Notice what he says. Those that go into battle are the same as those that tarry by the stuff. Something tells me that David learned a lesson when he took all 600 men out of Ziklag and went off to fight Israel with the Philistines. What would have happened if these 200 men, strong enough to fight, just couldn't march for days on end, had stayed there with those women and children? Those Amalekites wouldn't have looked out there at David's cattle and David's wives and David's children and all these men's stuff and said, "Oh, that's easy. They ain't a man in town." Instead, they would say, "There's 200 strong men there. Let's just go on around Ziklag." You see, it's important to have someone watching over your stuff. You women know that. "Would you watch my purse for me? Can you watch my purse?" I come in that door sometimes after we eat breakfast, and this invariably happens almost every Sunday. There's a man standing there in the hallway, different man every week, and he's holding a purse. Wife in the bathroom, yep. Some of you are looking at your husband, "Is that you doing that?" Yeah, there's about 10 of you. It's not one guy, it's about 10 guys. Sometimes it's two or three in one Sunday. It makes me wonder how trustworthy our church is. That women can't leave their purses laying around here. Has this been an ongoing problem? Do I need to address this as pastor? Do I need to settle some disputes on who's stealing purses? No. It's not because anyone at church has stolen your stuff. It's that you understand the value of having someone watch your stuff. Right? David said there's value in having 200 men sitting here watching our carts, watching our oxen, watching our donkeys, watching our tents, because we don't have a home in Ziklag and we need those tents. He said the people that do this task is just as important as the people that did the task we were on. And he said everybody gets the same amount of stuff, the same amount of spoil. That brings us to our fourth thought. We see the salute of David, the soldier's disdain, the settling of a dispute. Now it's the statute of David. Verse 25 makes it clear that this became a law. It says, and it was so from that day forward that he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel unto this day. That means it was an ongoing law. It means it wasn't just for this one battle. It meant that the next time they were in battle, they didn't come up and go, "Hey, David, how are we going to split everything? Like we did when we killed the Amalekites, or like when we did when we killed the Midianites. Hey, I might go to battle if I get more for going than I get for staying." No, it was just pretty much settled. If you could go to battle, you went to battle. If you couldn't go to battle, you stayed home. And everybody got the same amount of stuff. Because the people that stayed home were just as important as the people went to battle. Now it's a rule. It's an ongoing rule. It's a law. It's an ongoing law. What's the purpose of verse 25 telling us it's an ongoing law? It's reminding us that nobody challenged this law that David made in the future. Even after David died and Solomon became king, it was still a law. Even after Solomon died and the next person became king, it was still a law. It was an ongoing law. Why? Because it's an ongoing lesson. The lessons taught in what David did here are still applicable to you and I today. Can I make some application before we close? Or have you already zoned me out? You already got lunch on the brain. I don't want to make some applications here. All right? Let's look at some very practical things that we can see, learn from David in this, that still applies to you and I. How about supporting the supporters? Supporting the supporters. Think about this for just a moment. There are a lot of people who do stuff that nobody else sees, that don't get to do the glamorous jobs, that don't get to be in the spotlight, but the jobs they do are just as important as those in the spotlight, and nobody knows it. And you know what they all think? Nobody knows what I'm doing. Nobody knows what I'm going through. Nobody knows about my job. Nobody even knows that I do it. That's the best attitude you can have. If you don't mind doing a job that nobody else knows you do, you'll never get tired of doing it. You know when you get disgruntled with the job you have is when you think nobody's seeing you and you want them to see you. But if you have a group that's supporting the ministry of the church, shouldn't you also support them? And when someone's advocating cutting them out of the program, saying, "Hey, wait a minute, we need them just as much as we need this." Same is true in the business world. We must value all, but it's imperative that all, notice this, stay with the stuff. Now, if someone vacates the stuff and goes in a different direction and does a different thing, then we can't continue to value them. If your moral compass needle spins the other direction, I'm not going to go backing you up. But if you continue to believe what you believe today and continue to stay with God's Word, then the church ought to continue to stay and support you in whatever it is that you're doing. Think about it this way. Let's think about the settling of disputes. Too many times we settle disputes out of anger or rage. We get mad, we blow up, we say something we shouldn't, then we have to go back and apologize. Is it just me that does that? Huh? You've done that? Let's look at the way David handled his. Let me read you those words again. Correction. Yes, you must correct them. You can't just turn your blind eye to it. Parents, you can't just turn a blind eye and think your kids will grow out of it. They won't. They won't grow out of it. It's because you're called a parent and you ensure that they grow out of it. You've got to correct them. Problems in your life have to be corrected. You can't just be the ostrich sticking your head in the sand. You got to deal with the issue. So correct them, but do it compassionately, kindly, as you would with what David called his brethren. Then you've got to have credit given to where credit is due. When someone's wrong, you've got to call them wrong. When someone's right, you've got to express that they're right. And you've got to give the credit. And the reason for what we're doing has to be granted to God. Because if anything's being done in the church and it doesn't ultimately glorify God, the real question is, why in the world are we doing it? Confidence that what you're doing is right, the decision you've made is right. The only way that you and I will have true confidence in our decisions is if we first prayed about them or have clear biblical ground to stand on when we make corrections. When do you make swift corrections? When something's biblically wrong and it's obvious. Conclusion. You've got to find an end to the problem. You can't just pour water on it and leave it smoldering. You've got to put it out. How about this? Conclusion, application from this text. Never retire. Never retire. I have laying on my desk at this moment an 8-page survey from Lifeways, the Southern Baptist, I don't know what you call them, paperwork wing, okay? That's what I call them. Southern Baptist paperwork wing. And you know what this 8-page survey they want me to fill out is? How ready am I to retire? None of their business, but get this. I don't plan on retiring. I'm planning on dying. That's about it. I'm not going to quit working. My job may change. My role may change. I may not go into battle like I used to. I may spend a lot more time with the stuff, but I'm not quitting. I'm not going to try to get to 55 and hang up my Bible and go, oh, finally, I get to go fishing on Sunday. I do what I do because I like what I do. God's given me a love for what I do. I don't plan on retiring. But I don't have a secular job like you do either. My job is about 95% mental and about 5% physical. You have a physical job, you probably ought to plan on retiring. But let's talk about church. When do you get too old to retire from church? When do you get too old to serve God anymore and you just have to retire from serving God? You're right, you don't. When you look at these 200 men that could not go and they stayed with the stuff and they stayed home, the application here is that these people never retired from service with David. They just could no longer do the same service they started out doing. Here's the last thought I want to give you from the practical side. In every victory you're going to have in the winning team, men of Belial, men of Belial. I want you to think for just a moment. Sometimes we see God grant the victory and God's team over here wins and we look at that whole group and we say, boy, that must be the saved, right? That must be all the Christians over there. That must be all the God lovers over there. That must be God's chosen group of people over there. Even in that chosen group of people that got all their stuff back, that beat the Amalekites, there were men of Belial. There were crooked men with David. This has got a number of applications. Number one, don't be shocked when a church member does you wrong. We're easier to join than the Boy Scouts. Just because someone's a member here does not mean that they're sold out serving the Lord. Same goes for you if you're a member here. You're capable of doing something wrong. Even in David's company of victorious men that God blessed, there were wicked men in there that had wicked thoughts, gave out wicked ideas. Even in the church, no matter how sanctified it is, you will never ever run out all of the bad people. You know why you don't try to run out all the bad people? Because you run off about half the good ones trying to get them out. You remember the story of the parable of the wheat and the tares? You don't go around pulling up the tares because you tear up the wheat with it. It ain't like we're trying to find men of Belial, but rest assured, men of Belial are in every godly group. Men of Belial are in every victory that God has granted. Now those are the practical, physical, tangible applications you can make out of this. But let's look at some spiritual applications we can take from this text. I think about David's law, that the guys that stay with the stuff get the same as the guys that went out and did the heavy hitting. I would like to be the stay by the stuff guy. Y'all go get them. I'll be right here watching your stuff. I got you back. Godspeed. Stay safe out there. I'll be right here sitting on a sack of flour. I'll have pancakes when you get back. Wouldn't that be a gravy job? Huh? The problem is this. If you're capable of going after the enemy and you don't, I don't know if you're entitled to any of the stuff. These 200 men had to be made to stay by the brook Besor. They didn't want to stay by the brook Besor. Huh? Right? Did you see that? They wanted to keep going. David said, we'll never catch them if we keep traveling at the pace you're going. You have to stay here. I got a feeling a lot of people calling themselves Christians could do a lot more than what they're currently doing. They just don't want to. That was a pin drop hitting in the back. I know it ain't popular to hear. I've already preached it to myself all week. I'm not beating you up. I'm just being honest. Yeah, it's true. These men wanted to go get their wives and their kids back. They just weren't able. And a lot of good church members ain't doing anything because they don't want to, not because they can't. And the church says, we just don't have a place for you right now. Never ran out of places for people to serve, but I've always ran out of people to serve. That's a true statement. Think about it from the spiritual side. These men stayed with the stuff. Whose stuff did they stay with? King Saul's stuff? No, he was the enemy. The Philistine stuff? No, they were the enemy. They stayed with David's stuff. I wonder whose stuff you're standing by. Is it the Lord's stuff? Or is it just your stuff? Listen to me now. Think about this. Let's rationalize this out. Are you as concerned about losing the things you have as you are concerned about losing the relationship you have with God? Or do you put your relationship with God aside just to pick up and maintain all the stuff that you have? Been real busy this week, Lord. Don't have time. These are convicting questions for me. I don't know how they hit you, but boy, I don't like discussing them. But as I look at this text all week, I began to think, man, I've been doing a lot of sitting by the brook Bezor when I could have been on the heels of the Amalekites. Last thought here. I've never gone and did spiritual battle like the Apostle Paul has. Have you? Huh? You ever cast demons out of people? You ever been assaulted by the city government? You ever been stoned and left for dead? Drug outside the city? Never done that kind of battle. You ever been in a battle like Martin Luther, the Reformer, was, where the Roman Catholic Church was trying to find him and kill him and throw him in prison, and people had contract out on his life, and everywhere he went, mercenaries were trying to kill him, governments were trying to hunt him down, his books were being burned. You ever been in that kind of spiritual battle where the government's trying to arrest you? You ever been like Charles Spurgeon, where the newspapers wrote bad things about you because of what you preached? You ever been like Charles Spurgeon where other churches hated you because of what you preached? You ever been like Charles Spurgeon that you were so burdened by the condition of the sinful people in your town you died at the age of 58? I hadn't either. I've never been in a battle like the Apostle Paul or like Martin Luther or like Charles Spurgeon. But do you know what this text is very clear about, Christian? The people that stayed with the stuff get the same part as the people that went to battle. Oh, my stars, I confessed already that I've sat by the brook Bezor when I should have been in pursuit of the enemy. Huh? Maybe I'm the only guy that's ever sat down when I should have been in battle. But that's all right, I'll own it. You know what? I may never be in that kind of a battle. You know why? Maybe I'm not equipped. Maybe I'm going to be one of the weaklings that stays by the stuff. Does that mean God won't receive me? Does that mean God won't save me? Does that mean unless I go out and do what these guys did, I don't have anything coming? No, it's the law in Israel from David on that those that go into battle get the same as those that stay with the stuff. The key is not what you've accomplished. Key is your faithfulness. If you can't go down into battle, you can stay with the stuff. That's the key. So I ask you, whose stuff are you sticking with? Whose army are you in? Are you capable of going down to battle? Are you just dragging your feet, slowing everyone else down? These are questions I did not like answering. But I'll be honest with you. I've drugged my feet. I've sat down. I've sipped ice water in the shade. And I thought I've really been in the heat of the battle. Then I began to look at real soldiers of the cross. Began to look at people doing real combat. And I said, I may never do that. I may never live that life. I may never experience those things. And then it hit me. It don't matter if I've ever done those things. Here's what matters. Have I fought here where I am? Have I been faithful here where I am? Am I doing what God has gifted me to do where I am? Am I faithful? Christian, that's the question I want you to answer today. You know you're saved. You know you're in the right army. You know you're in a battle. Are you sitting down when you should be fighting? Are you sitting with the right stuff? Do you honestly know Jesus Christ? Do you have a real relationship with God through Him? Does the Holy Spirit dwell in you as evidenced by His fruits in your life? These are real questions that need to be answered. And I'd rather you leave and go home mad and hear the truth as I would not address them. And I want to address them like David addressed problems, compassionately. So I plead with you. Not because I'm mad at you, but because I love you. Answer these questions. Are you sticking with the stuff? Have you been faithful with what you've been given? Because if you have, you'll get the same reward as everyone else. You don't have to outdo anybody. You just have to be faithful where you are. Amen.